From Eye in the Sky to Killer Robots, a podcast by the International Panel on the Regulation of Autonomous Weapons, led by the German Institute for International and Security Affairs.
Hello, I'm Kevin Canners, and this is the SWP podcast with a special episode by our project, IPRA, the International Panel on the Regulation of Autonomous Weapons. We all know from watching the news that armed conflict and war essentially creates hell on earth.
Ukrainian officials say there is new audio revealing Russian soldiers talking about killing and raping Ukrainian civilians.
People are killed, cities are destroyed, and the things that have been lovingly built up for decades reduced to rubble. Just look to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we can clearly see that conventional warfare is bad enough. But imagine a world where it's not soldiers doing the fighting, but autonomous weapon systems. These autonomous weapon systems can select and engage military targets, including people, without further human intervention. War was already bad, but with this, we're potentially in the realm of nightmares, dystopian sci-fi novels, and Hollywood films. But with the rapid development of artificial intelligence, or AI technology, such a possibility could soon not just be the realm of science fiction, but of real life. They're called Lethal Autonomous Weapon Systems, or LAWS for short. And while fully autonomous weapon systems still don't exist yet outside of very specific, mostly defensive applications, increasingly, AI and autonomous functions are being built into offensive weapon systems. And with militaries continuously investing in new technology, many fear and expect smarter and more autonomous systems are coming.
We can definitely see an increase in autonomy in weapon systems, and these changes are continuously happening.
This is Elizabeth Hofberger-Pippin.
I am researcher at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs.
But the reason we're interested in talking to Elizabeth is because she is also the head of something called IPRA, which stands for the International Panel on the Regulation of Autonomous Weapons. IPRA is an interdisciplinary group of researchers and experts that was formed specifically to study autonomous weapon systems and advise the German Bundestag, as well as delegates from around the world, about some of the issues having to do with these weapons, and potentially how they could be regulated.
So we come together on a regular basis. We discuss autonomous weapon systems from various angles and different perspectives, such as law, international politics, and also ethics. We write reports. We have also workshops, and we're using our reports to advise the UN Group of Governmental Experts in Geneva on autonomous weapon systems.
According to Elizabeth, right now, the area in which we see the most development of autonomous weapon capabilities are in unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. And unmanned aerial vehicles is an umbrella term, which covers drones, but also autonomous weapon systems. So what is actually the difference between a drone and an autonomous weapon system? Well, when it comes to drones, strictly speaking, the human operator still retains the capacity to decide whether or not to engage a particular target. But when it comes to flying autonomous weapon systems, it's the machine itself undertaking the task of selecting, but also engaging the target. And the reason why these weapons are being developed is because militaries see strategic advantages in giving weapon systems more autonomous functions. Computers can be much more efficient than humans and could identify targets more quickly and numerously than human operators. And for better or worse, they could also kill them faster and possibly more reliably.
My name is Anja Dahlmann. I'm a political scientist, member and co-founder of IPRO, and currently I'm the head of the Berlin office of the Institute for Peace Research and Security Policy.
This is Anja Dahlmann, the co-founder of IPRO. And Anja gives the case of a drone as an example why militaries might want to transfer the competence of selecting and engaging targets entirely to machines. Say your weapon system just identified a very high-profile target. then you wouldn't want to give that target the time or chance to get away while the drone waits for confirmation from a human operator that this target should indeed be fired at.
If you need always this link from the platform to the human decision maker or operator, then it takes a lot of time. You have the satellite connection between the drone and the operator, for example, and then the human operator takes a long time to decide. And if you want to cut that out and be sure that this communication link can't be broken, then you will put more autonomy on the platform, right?
But that reliability isn't the only reason why militaries would be interested in giving intelligent weapon systems more autonomy. For example, autonomous weapon systems are a force multiplier, which means fewer soldiers are needed on the battlefield. Autonomous weapons also allow the military to reach into areas that would normally be inaccessible for humans. And in general, proponents of autonomous weapons argue that they can be used for dull, dirty, or dangerous missions. Also, unlike human beings, AI systems, of course, don't have emotions. So they won't kill just because of a human emotion in the heat of an operation, nor will they hesitate. Autonomy could also be helpful in weapon systems which are defensive. Like, for instance, with the Israel Iron Dome, which already exists, and which can quickly and at times automatically intercept enemy rockets that are at risk of landing within civilian areas within the country. And on that note, it's worth mentioning that autonomous weapon systems could really be anything. Not just unmanned aerial vehicles or defensive systems, they could also be, say, tanks that roam around a battlefield, or miniature submarines that patrol the ocean. They could even be small robots that are released in the field. Simply put, they can be anything that comes with a level of autonomy when it comes to selecting and engaging targets. So maybe it's obvious why the military research departments of the world might want to develop weapon systems that have more and more autonomy. They could be more efficient in war and potentially take out targets quicker and more reliably. But while there's clear advantages if you're a general sitting in the Pentagon, there are no shortage of concerns that giving weapon systems more autonomy can bring up. What would it mean for a weapon system to kill targets all on its own? What if these systems malfunctioned and started targeting civilians? What about the AI-fueled arms race that this could set off? And what if a non-state actor got their hands on one of these systems and changed its parameters? Then there are all the questions of how the AI itself would function. For example, how would an autonomous weapon know if a target was already injured or surrendering? How would it know the difference between someone pretending to give up and someone actually giving up? Or what about irregular warfare and identifying and engaging combatants if they're not wearing uniforms? So obviously, while possibly helpful in some contexts, these weapon systems come with a whole raft of questions and concerns. And you don't need a wild imagination to think about the dystopian futures in which autonomous weapons, basically robots which have literally been designed to kill people, somehow get out of hand and unleash terrible consequences. But somewhat disconcertingly, despite these dangers, right now there are no international rules specifically about lethal autonomous weapons. Here's Anya Dalman again.
So at the moment, autonomous weapons are not regulated.
They're not regulated, at least not yet. But there are other rules in place applicable to parties to an armed conflict, irrespective of which weapons they deploy.
There are, of course, laws and rules in place, like international humanitarian law, that applies to every weapon, including those with autonomous functions. Let's say you have to distinguish between civilians and combatants, and things have to be proportional and all that. So that applies. But what that actually means, if you take out the human decision maker to a certain extent, that is something that needs to be explored and regulated ultimately.
So Anya mentioned that there's international humanitarian law, or IHL for short. International humanitarian law regulates the conduct of war in general. So what means of war can be used, how weapons can be employed, and how prisoners of war should be treated. Its job is to lessen the harm that war does to both civilians and combatants. International humanitarian law consists basically of four different treaties, the four Geneva Conventions and its two additional protocols. And it largely reflects customary law, which means that even states that haven't ratified the Geneva Conventions are still held to it. And IHL has three principles, that of distinction, proportionality, and of precaution in attack. The principle of distinction says, for example, that you have to distinguish between combatants and civilians, and refrain from directly engaging civilians. But although international humanitarian law applies to all weapon systems, the various tenets of it are formulated in a very broad way. So, just as has been done with many other weapon systems, from landmines to lasers, it might be desirable to create an international treaty with regulations specifically addressing autonomous weapon systems to get a more appropriate level of control and precaution. It's something I imagine that most of us would think is a good idea. And fortunately, there is a process to do just that. It's pursued under the CCW, a convention that is part of the UN framework, and it takes place primarily in Geneva.
The CCW is the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons and is basically a framework to regulate various means and methods of warfare. So they did this with incendiary weapons and remnants of warfare and things like that. And now they might add autonomous weapons to this mix.
So there's the CCW, the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, whose job it is to regulate certain weapon categories and set out general standards. And attached to the CCW are, at the moment, five different protocols regulating specific weapons, things like incendiary weapons, booby traps, and explosive remnants of war. And back in 2014, the CCW first started holding informal expert meetings about autonomous weapons. Then in 2017, they started something more formal, something called the UN Group of Governmental Experts, or the GGE. This GGE is basically a gathering of representatives from countries around the world, where they discuss possible ways of addressing these lethal autonomous weapon systems, again called LAWS for short. And I know that's a lot of acronyms, but the important thing is that, at least in theory, this group called the GGE, made up of governments from around the world, could come up with a recommendation for how autonomous weapons with lethal capabilities could be regulated. And this could either be a formal protocol within the CCW regulating autonomous weapon systems, as was done in the case of blinding laser weapons, or, if this proves too difficult, there could be a non-binding document within the GGE laying out some principles of agreement among the participating countries when it comes to autonomous weapons. And so, since 2017, at this GGE in Geneva, governments from around the world have been having discussions on exactly these questions.
Whether autonomous weapon systems should be regulated and in which way they should be regulated, should they be entirely prohibited, and so on and so forth.
So at least with the GGE in Geneva, a process exists where these weapons are being looked at and discussed in an international multilateral sense. These talks usually don't sound exciting.
So paragraph 44 to 48 of the draft report.
But they're doing important work. But up until now, even though the GGE has been taking place for 5 years, there has been relatively little progress. And to understand why, here's Elizabeth.
So the biggest problem in the UN GGE or in the whole conventional weapons convention framework is work is done based on consensus. So that means each state has, in fact, the power to obstruct a process or to say no to a certain regulation. And this is very challenging for the entire CCW process.
So every single country has a veto and can stop something from moving forward. And if you've ever tried to find a movie on Netflix when there's five or more friends together, you know that collective decision-making is easier said than done. So maybe no wonder why, at least if you ask Anya, even though they've been talking for several years now, not much has been accomplished in terms of getting actual regulations on the table.
No, annoyingly, nothing happened, or not much happened. They really failed to come up with even a draft for a regulation.
And it's maybe especially not surprising, because the range of views among countries at this GGE about how and even whether these weapons should be regulated really runs the gamut. And as Anya explained to me, among the delegations at these talks in Geneva, there are really two main camps.
we can see a certain divide between states that have already invested a lot in the development of autonomous weapons and those that are not capable of doing this at the moment. So basically, it's Global South that is in favor of a regulation or prohibition of autonomous weapon systems. And then, for example, the United States and Australia, Russia, they are really opposed towards a regulation and limitations to their own capabilities.
So it comes down, more or less, to the fact that countries that have advanced militaries, like the US and Russia, are less in favor of regulation, while countries from the Global South and many European countries that have far smaller military budgets are more in favor of regulation. It's kind of like if you were a billionaire running for a political office. You'd probably be far happier with fewer regulations on campaign finance compared to your middle-class opponents. But at least countries have come together to discuss autonomous weapons. And it's not like nothing has been achieved.
So what happened was that I think the issue became much clearer. So the problem definition went on and states got a much better understanding of what autonomous weapons could be, what legal and ethical issues they might raise, and hopefully also how to tackle that to a certain extent. They also created 11 guiding principles where they say, well, international humanitarian law applies, the human should stay accountable for everything that happens, and the human-machine interaction is an important issue that has to be solved for regulation, things like that.
One of the most interesting things to me has been learning just how difficult even really basic questions are in this multilateral process. Like just defining the problem or what we're talking about. That simple thing is actually surprisingly difficult when we're talking about these weapons, which is something that we'll come back to a bit later. So with so many countries and so many opinions, it can feel like an uphill battle to get anything done at the GGE. But in a way, that's exactly why IPRA, the group that Elizabeth and Anya are members of, was founded. It was created essentially to write reports and give neutral background information that delegations could use to help inform their discussions at the GGE. It was a way to contribute to the process and maybe help delegates from various countries find some kind of consensus from a rather difficult starting place. Anya explains.
When the GGE, the Group of Governmental Experts, started, many voices came, for example, from states parties and their experts, which have a certain view, of course, and we thought there might be room for someone else. And the basic idea was if we can bring together experts with very different views from different backgrounds, different regions, and if they can come up with a consensus report on certain issues, then that might be helpful for delegates that want to create a regulation in a consensus-based forum like the CCW.
So it was from this basic premise that IPRA started to develop.
So the first head of IPRA was Marcel Dico, at that time a researcher at SWP, this Berlin-based think tank. And he and, well, to a certain extent, I came up with that idea and discussed it with the German Federal Foreign Office. And they were generously funding the whole project, so travel budgets and also my position, our research assistant, and supported the project in that way.
And it's worth quickly mentioning here that while IPRA is financed by Germany's Federal Foreign Office, it is an independent body and comes up with its own views and positions.
And then we brought together this international group, this network of experts, some of who we knew already, some of whom we discovered in the process, because we really wanted to cover basically all regions of the world. And then we wanted to include lawyers as well as ethicists, political scientists, physicists, computer scientists, so really diverse backgrounds to get a good broad perspective on issues of laws, because we wanted to understand the technology behind it, but also the ethical implications and challenges. So it's really a very broad field and you have to understand at least a bit about everything to make an informed recommendation.
What they then had after selecting members was a network of researchers with interdisciplinary backgrounds from many different countries around the world, all of whom have a certain expertise in a field relevant to autonomous weapons or their regulation. And kind of like a mini GGE, they started coming together to discuss the issue of autonomous weapons. And they wanted to use their diverse expertise to really examine in detail the various issues that arise from these weapons.
So our approach for IPRO was that we met over the course of first 2 years and then for a longer time on a regular basis, about every 3 months. And kind of picked up various aspects like technology, like computational methods or AI, And there we would have inputs from, for example, the computer scientists who explain to us how does machine learning work and what does it do to a weapon system, for example. So to give the others a better understanding. And then we discussed this issue from all the perspectives and then came up with a short report on that particular issue, for example, explaining always with delegates of the CCW in mind, explaining what that means, what machine learning means for regulation of laws, for example.
For instance, Anya also gives the example of the issue of ethics with these weapon systems, which they discussed in IPRA.
So in the ethics discussion, I think that was the hardest part. We discussed the role of human dignity. And for some, human dignity is like this value in itself. And if you notice that autonomous weapon systems and their use violate the dignity of the human target, then you're out, then you can't use this. While others say maybe there's room for deliberation or negotiation with other values, like saving lives of civilians, for example, in certain scenarios. So it might be okay to violate the human dignity of the target. And there we really had a long, long and ongoing discussion how to deal with that. And I think in the report, we solved it pretty well to say those are the options. Like you can have a more utilitarian approach or more deontological approach to this. And if you go this way or that, a regulation would look different like this and that. So we kind of solved it by really laying out the options for the delegates in the room in Geneva.
And then these various reports, like the one on ethics, were made widely available on iPRA.org for delegates and anyone else to draw on and use as a resource. Here's Elizabeth again, the current head of iPRA.
So the reports are online available on our homepage, and we also had them in paper and brought them to Geneva, and the states could just simply grab them and read them, and this happened very often. And to me, it was very interesting to see how much, actually, states really wanted to engage with IPRO in discussions.
And to give you an example, here's Isabel Sarrazin, a German representative at the GGE.
My name is Isabel Sarrazin, and I work with the Federal Foreign Office in the division that works on conventional arms control. I found the papers very helpful when I prepared for the negotiations, or in between also for taking a closer look at what is going on in the other states. The papers were very helpful, and I recommend them to anybody who's interested in the subject.
And can you tell me why they were helpful?
There was one paper, just as an example, that spelled out in more detail national regulations in the field of autonomy or military use of artificial intelligence. And they looked at specific states and the regulations at their national levels. And that is just helpful because it's something that you don't get to do in the course of your work. But it's important, of course, to get a better background understanding.
And maybe that's one reason why IPRA's reports have been so useful for delegates. Because unlike other civil society organizations that follow the discussions in Geneva, for example, like the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, which Elizabeth is quick to point out serves an important function and does great work, IPRA itself is neutral. It shares a diversity of opinions and possible paths forward in terms of what regulations or non-binding agreements could look like. And that gives IPRA some advantages.
IPRA is not a conglomerate of scientists striving for a legally binding treaty. What we try to do is to show the different delegates that there are various options available. So we wanted to be rather neutral and say, you can do this and this has this and this advantage. Or you could do the other thing and this a disadvantage or this disadvantage. So we try to be rather neutral. We try to show the various options that are available, but we do not consider ourselves activists because we don't just tell states what they should do. We offer options.
And just like the countries meeting at the GGE, Elizabeth told me that the views among members of IPRA also range wildly. Some members are very in favor of a legally binding treaty regulating laws, while others are more open to the idea of a non-binding document that could come out of the GGE. But according to Elizabeth, this range of views is a strength, not a weakness.
In the reports, we try to reflect the pluralism in our group that we have different opinions.
But back to those divergent opinions at the GGE of the countries themselves. As we said, there is a pretty big range of opinions at the GGE, from countries that want a legally binding treaty and a complete ban on fully autonomous weapons, to those that aren't at all ready to commit to that. Here's Elizabeth.
So there are, for example, there's the group of the G13, a bunch of different states from Latin America, from Asia, from Africa. And the G13, they try to say, we need a legally binding treaty in order to regulate laws adequately. On the very opposite side, there are states such as the United States, Israel, Russia, India, and they say, okay, we don't need a legally binding treaty. What we can agree on is maybe some kind of legally non-binding document, but even that would be, for example, too much for the Russian delegation. And Germany always tried to find kind of a counterbalance between these positions.
At the conference in Geneva, we spoke to some of the countries that are more in favor of regulation. First up, here's Austria.
My name is Susanne Hammer. I work at the Austrian Foreign Ministry in the Disarmament Department, specifically on the issue of autonomous weapon systems. Certainly for us, autonomous weapon systems are one of the major challenges the international disarmament community is facing today. Austria is of the view that we urgently should have clear international rules that apply to these systems. That means that systems that are politically or legally unacceptable should be explicitly prohibited by international law. And we feel that such regulation should be urgently worked on.
And here is Reto Vollenmann, who works in the Federal Department of Foreign Affairs of Switzerland and who is also in favor of a regulation on laws.
Yes, my name is Reto Vollenmann. I'm with the Swiss delegation in the CCW negotiation process. We do think regulation is needed. We hope this can be done in the CCW before not too long. We have now a window of opportunity, a window to act. The Swiss position is that we want to prevent those weapons that are unacceptable. Those are primarily those that cannot be used in conformity with international humanitarian law, and also those that raise certain ethical concerns. It's about stability, it's about non-proliferation, etc.
So Switzerland and Austria are both in favor of strong binding regulations on these weapons. But of course, Switzerland and Austria are two countries without massive militaries, which is maybe the challenge with these international arms regulation discussions. To get anything meaningful passed, you need the big military powers to agree and get on board. Here's Elizabeth again.
I'm coming from Austria, and Austria has a very strong position towards autonomous weapon systems. But the tricky question is, how do we get states on board that are key military power players? Austria is not a military power player. This is also something we have to admit. It's great if Austria, you know, takes action, but we need NATO members on board. We need Russia. If there is any chance, we need China to agree on something. This is the really tricky question.
And as an example of one of those bigger powers, here again is Elizabeth explaining the position of the United States, which is less in favor of a binding treaty against autonomous weapons, because they argue that autonomous weapon systems don't yet exist.
This is just an argument that has at least been forwarded or that has been used by the United States. So they think that autonomous weapon systems in the classical sense, they don't exist yet. And so we are talking about preventive regulation. And this might hamstring research and development. So the United States is taking a different approach. Maybe we should test, evaluate, conduct research on our research projects first, see what happens, see how the outcomes are, see the pitfalls, the advantages, the disadvantages, and after having carefully analyzed those weapon systems that are currently being developed or that are being planned to be developed in the future, then we should ask ourselves, how can they be regulated? So I think that they are just cautious about regulating preventively a weapon system that, according to their opinion, does not exist yet.
So you have the countries that are very pro-regulation and those that want to keep their options open, maybe research these tools a bit more and perhaps give their militaries a leg up in the process. And somewhere in the middle, according to Elizabeth, between the two groups is Germany's position. Germany and France both suggest the so-called two-tier approach, differentiating between fully and partially autonomous weapon systems. And just to quickly explain, fully autonomous weapon systems are those that would be capable of changing their rules of operation, meaning they could change or broaden what they target, or they could extend a mission, for example, all on their own. Whereas partially autonomous weapons, on the other hand, are those that would only operate within certain limits and would not be capable of changing the objectives of a mission or the category of targets that they were assigned to attack. Here's Isabel Sarrazin again, one of the German representatives at these talks.
France and Germany have together promoted the two-tier approach, and we hope that this might help gain more common ground. So we try to differentiate between two types of autonomous weapon systems. First of all, fully lethal autonomous weapon systems that operate completely outside human control. And we suggested that the state parties commit themselves not to develop, produce, acquire, deploy, or use these kind of weapon systems. And then second, weapon systems that have autonomous functions. And we suggested that the state parties agreed only to develop, acquire, deploy, use, modify these kinds of weapon systems under certain regulations.
So Germany divides the problem into two. It wants a ban on fully autonomous weapons and regulations that would apply to weapon systems that have some autonomous functions, which would ensure that these partially autonomous weapon systems are used in compliance with legal and ethical standards and an adequate level of human-machine interaction. But this is where, again, you can see how complicated this topic is. Because as I mentioned earlier, just simply defining what autonomous weapons are is surprisingly controversial.
It is very difficult and very complicated because many people have many different approaches when it comes to defining lethal autonomous weapon systems.
One of the key things that comes up over and over again in these discussions at the GGE about autonomous weapons, and also in the stated positions of countries, is the issue of human control. Hang out for long enough in this field, and you'll soon spot that term everywhere. Basically, the question is, how much human control should be required of these autonomous systems? In other words, what would constitute sufficient human oversight over these systems to make sure that these systems are, say, selecting targets appropriately and not killing innocent civilians, or doing something else random and destructive? Here's Anya Dahlmann again, the co-founder of IPRA.
I think the major sticking point is really this question of human control, what that means, how to define that, and how to apply this to a regulation.
And this question quickly gets quite philosophical. What's meaningful human control over an autonomous system that can select and kill human targets? How do you define it? Like, for example, if you release an unmanned aerial vehicle that can kill a target on its own after a human has approved it, then as Anya says, the question is,
like, how far in the past has a human decision been made? Like, someone flipped a switch 3 weeks ago and now this drone is going on there, that might be problematic.
And human control is also a topic that is talked about almost in passionate terms by delegates. Here's Susanna Hammer of Austria again.
For Austria, it is central that humans keep control over the weapon system, especially when it comes to selecting or choosing and attacking a target. We believe that we cannot leave decisions over life and death to mere algorithms without any human control. So if you want the fear, in a sense, is that we have humans losing control over weapon systems, which would ultimately result in humans losing control over armed conflict. If the machines are pre-programmed on an algorithm and there is no possibility to intervene, what does it mean for any peace efforts, for any diplomatic efforts?
But as with the example from Anya, or flipping a switch 3 weeks ago, it's also hard to just make a blanket rule. Because another aspect that would influence these considerations about what constitutes adequate human control is what kind of environment a particular weapon is operating in.
It depends on how cluttered the environment is, meaning how many civilians, for example, could enter the scenery, and many other aspects that have to be considered. And those make up this context. And for example, the more dynamic and, let's say, cluttered the environment is, the more human control you might need, because things can change so quickly and because you need to understand the context in a specific situation.
So, for example, if you have an autonomous system designed to protect a submarine in the middle of the ocean or a base in the Arctic, that's a lot different than a system protecting an embassy in a big capital city. Here's Reto Vollermann from the Swiss delegation again.
Clearly, when you are in, for instance, in an urban area with lots of civilians, where situations radically, quickly change, you need a lot more control. You want to have less autonomy for the weapon system to make those decisions themselves. You want to have the human really closely involved. However, we know the examples where you have air defense systems or systems against incoming missiles, where you have less a chance that there is encounters with a civilian population or with civilian objects. And there you can have maybe less control.
So you can see that quickly, you get into very case-by-case scenarios. And you see again the problem with coming up with an agreement. Not only do we have these divergent views, but the definitions are hard. What we mean by sufficient control is hard. All these issues are difficult. But ideally, you still need to move forward with some kind of overall agreement or binding regulation that would apply to all of these weapon systems and in a way that would make sense. Not so easy. But of course, that's everyone's job to do, to find a solution, including IPRAS.
IPRA has suggested a concrete terminology that could be used in a future treaty or in a legally non-binding document how we could implement and operationalize human control. IPRA, for example, argues that human control is situational awareness and options for human intervention, and both needs to be enabled by the design of a weapon system, but also it has to be maintained during use of a weapon system. And this is an approach that has been suggested by IPRO.
But with all of this to consider, no wonder that Isabel Zauzin, the German representative, told me that when selecting a position at a forum like the GGE as a country, you have to keep in mind that you're trying to put forward a position that ideally many different countries could agree to in general.
So I would say that is an important factor that you will take into account. You cannot just come up with something, but you need to come up with something that enables all the other partners or states to go along with you. So that is something important that you have to keep in mind.
Which is why Germany went with their two-tier approach that sidesteps some of the trickier aspects of defining what these weapons are in detail. And according to Isabel, to that end, they feel that their joint approach with France has been successful.
Actually, we do have the impression that it gains traction in the process, and it is being quoted during the discussions by states and non-state participants. So we have the impression that it helps to gain common ground, and we hope we can promote this approach further.
But Isabel says that it's not just the view of other countries that you have to take into consideration when forming your position as a country.
You will also take into account, for example, contributions from civil society members, such as the International Panel on the Regulation of Autonomous Weapons. They provided very profound and in-depth analysis and recommendations, and these will also be taken into account, just as the broad and active participation of other members of civil society during the negotiations in Geneva.
So civil society also has a big role to play. And to speak to that, here's Marisela Munoz.
My name is Marisela Munoz. I am a former delegate of the delegation of Costa Rica at UNOC and currently a government fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy.
And Marisela has a unique insight into the role that outside parties play in these discussions.
You know, as a former diplomat, I always enjoyed and appreciated how civil society organizations can present evidence-based arguments, you know, and scientific information that can be then digested and incorporated into the position of states. Because at the end of the day, this is a consensus-based convention and states are the ones making the calls. But that contribution is really invaluable because sometimes we lack the resources, the time, or of the expertise to come up with this knowledge that civil society organizations have. And also, you know, this privileged position in which you can compile the sentiments of the general public and what the international community is expecting of states. And so that bridging role is really, really important, and I cannot underscore it enough.
And it's not just IPRA. There are many organizations that attend these GGE meetings and contribute their views to the process. For example, there's the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the ICRC.
So my name is Maya Brehm. I'm a legal advisor with the Arms and Conduct of Hostilities Unit at the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC. The ICRC is an impartial, neutral, and independent organization whose exclusively humanitarian mission is to protect the lives and dignity of victims of armed conflict and other situations of violence, including, of course, the civilians, from autonomous weapons.
The Red Cross is a more advocacy-situated organization than IPRA.
We are concerned that this change in how humans are involved in the use of weapons brings risks of harm for those people affected by armed conflict, both civilians but also combatants, as well as dangers of conflict escalation. And to our mind, this raises fundamental ethical concerns for humanity because, in effect, in this way of applying force, human decisions about life and death are substituted with sensor software and machine processes. Earlier this year, in May 2021, the ICRC offered a set of more specific recommendations to all states. And among these recommendations is that we would like to see states to adopt new legally binding rules, including prohibitions on what we call unpredictable autonomous weapons, prohibition on autonomous weapons used to target persons directly, and then a set of limitations and requirements to strictly regulate the use of all other autonomous weapons.
And it's critical to stress how important civil society has been in putting this issue of regulating autonomous weapons on the agenda in the first place. Here's IPRA's Anya Dahlman again.
So civil society in this regulation process on autonomous weapons played a huge role, because without civil society and especially a campaign to stop killer robots and others, we wouldn't see this debate at the CCW at the moment.
It wouldn't even exist, you mean?
Yeah. So they defined this issue, like autonomy and weapon system, it's a thing. Someone should talk about this, like in 2011, 2013. They really raised this issue and raised awareness for that and framed the issue in a specific way, like as a problem for international humanitarian law. And without that, states wouldn't have been able to pick that up in a forum like the CCW. And then afterwards, they really shaped the debate and added the frame of, for example, meaningful human control, which is like the big issue now, and keep playing an important role.
And so you said without that, it probably wouldn't be on the agenda at all as a topic.
Basically, yes.
But back to the talks among the countries themselves. Back at the GGE meeting of December 2021, delegates, while being fully aware of the challenges ahead, seemed at least partially optimistic that they were building towards a common understanding, and maybe one day a regulation. Here's Rachel Vollmann, the Swiss delegate, once more.
What we know is that views differ. There's still a long way to go to find consensus on a number of key points. We have, however, I think, made good progress on a number of conceptual issues over the past year and a half, 2 years. So we do hope that in this specific setting where we are in now, time is running out, the delegates will find some flexibility and agree on really what is key. I think what we need to walk away with is a positive feeling that the CCW can do something in this regard. We can get a few principles on paper. We can get the basic structure of a future regulation on paper.
And the Austrian delegate, Susanna Hammer.
Certainly, it is positive that states agreed to continue the discussions. We believe that gradually over time, the expert group has narrowed down its focus. And that was clearly pointing towards the direction of an international regulation.
So things were moving along slowly. I mean, very slowly. But there seemed to be at least some progress in agreeing on terms and definitions, the basics. And there was hope that all of this would set the stage for a real agreement. But then, in February of this year, things took an abrupt turn.
Good morning from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Gunfire and explosions have been heard here and in the second city of Kharkiv shortly after the Russian president Vladimir.
That's when the Russian invasion of Ukraine began. And when the GGE met in Geneva again in March, after the war had been launched, the mood in the room had radically changed. Any spirit of goodwill or multilateralism that had existed between Russia and Western countries had basically in an instant vanished. I spoke to Elizabeth, the head of IPRA, afterwards about how she felt now about the chance of regulations being achieved through the GGE.
Well, when I started working for this project, I was not very, very optimistic, but I still had a lot of hope. And I knew from the very beginning that this process would be very exhausting and very challenging, most of all very challenging. But the Russian war in Ukraine changed basically everything, because we as civil society representatives just had the impression in the last GGE in March 2022 that Russia was basically obstructing the entire process.
Remember how every single country gets a veto with this process? Well, that also makes it extremely easy for one country, acting potentially in bad faith, to ensure that no progress whatsoever is made. They can simply grind things to a halt. And it seems that's what Russia did quite openly with the use of boring procedural matters. For example, at this GGE meeting this past March,
Russia said, we want the UN GGE to change from formal mode to informal mode.
And while to most of us that doesn't sound like a big deal, in the world of UN bodies that regulates weapons, it really is.
This is very significant, because if you change from formal to informal, this means everything you're discussing cannot be taken into consideration when drafting the final report of the UN GGE. That means when, for example, Switzerland or Germany says something in informal mode, when you're drafting the report, you cannot take these statements into consideration. So Russia tried to obstruct the process.
And it wasn't just by changing it to informal mode that Russia was obstructing the process.
Russia also did not agree on the particular agenda, and it also criticized the rules of procedure.
And while Russia, of course, outwardly claimed that they were doing this for perfectly reasonable reasons, for Elizabeth, it seemed clear.
Russia really wanted to use all these excuses to obstruct the process. They extended deliberations on procedural matters for a very long time, because what we also have to take into consideration is we only have 10 days this year for the UN GGE, which is not a lot.
Only 10 days in the whole year to meet and discuss these complex topics and slowly work towards an agreement of some kind. So if Russia wants to talk about procedural matters for a couple of days, everything just grinds to a halt, and there's no real chance anything of substance will occur. And Elizabeth says that this is really frustrating for anyone who even remotely wants any regulations or agreement to happen.
I mean, after the first, let's say, 2 days at the UN GGE in March, everyone was just frustrated. Some delegates were even speaking openly about their frustration. To a certain degree, in a very emotional way, and delegates, they, of course, are very professional people, but you could see that this war really affected all of them. So it was a very moving week, to be honest, especially for civil society, of course.
And so in practical terms, after what happened in March, things are basically stuck. And with every country having a veto, there's not much anyone can do. Now, any optimism that Elizabeth had about the GGE process is basically gone.
I think right now the tensions and the political climate is so bad that moving forward with Russia included seems to be off the table, because it's just almost impossible to get somewhere with Russia. I have the impression that most of the states still want to discuss the issue of laws in the GGE. However, they also see that Russia's behavior is not going to change anytime soon. I think that most states, most delegations expect Russia to behave in the same way in the July GGE. So I think states should be aware that maybe the GGE is not going to be the forum in the future where autonomous weapons are going to be discussed. I think states should prepare for this eventuality.
Which is to say that it's failed.
Exactly.
Then the question is, if the GGE has failed, where does that leave us? Does the process have to leave the GGE to get anything done?
So that means many states are now probably preparing for alternative avenues, for alternative fora, but they don't want to openly say the GGE has failed. But civil society organizations do that, and in my personal opinion, the GGE has failed.
So it's not ideal. But what would the options be for getting something done outside of the GGE? Elizabeth says that a more independent process, started by a state or a group of states, could be one answer.
There could be states which say, well, let's have an independent process. Let's meet at our capital and let's discuss how we can find a legally binding treaty on laws. This is also an option. We had that in the past with, for example, the conventional cluster munitions and other legally binding documents.
And this approach, set up by a group of states, would come with the big advantage that you could keep things moving forward without Russia or other states that are opposed to regulations slowing things down. The downside is, of course, that it would then not be an inclusive process. It would be very likely that if any agreement was reached among an independent group of countries, that major military powers like Russia and the United States wouldn't sign on. And they're really the ones that you need to agree to regulations, since by and large, they're the ones with the military budgets to research, produce, and operate complex new weapon systems. And if one country invests in new weapon technology, other countries have an incentive to do the same, simply to ensure their own safety, a classic security dilemma. But this scenario of setting up an independent process, both in its positive and negative attributes, is basically exactly what happened with the Ottawa Treaty, or the Anti-Personnel Landmines Convention. Back in the 90s, efforts to regulate landmines were going through the slow and difficult, but inclusive, CCW and GGE process. But it wasn't really getting anywhere since there was no consensus. So a group of states left the forum to work on an agreement elsewhere. And in the end, at a conference in Ottawa, they succeeded. In 1997, 121 governments signed the convention, and a legally binding treaty that banned the stockpiling and use of personnel landmines was signed. It was hailed as a big victory in many quarters. So there can be successes, even when the CCW and GGE process feels like it has failed and has nowhere to go. But it also shows you the difficult nature of getting something achieved. Among the signatories to the Landmines Treaty, even today, you won't find the United States, Russia, or China. But nonetheless, it was a process that saw over 100 countries commit not to use, stockpile, produce, or trade anti-personnel mines. And many countries got rid of the landmines that they did have. So maybe there's a lesson to be drawn there. And for her part, Elizabeth says that it's important to keep going forward with these efforts to regulate autonomous weapons.
I think even though the time's very difficult right now, especially for arms control in general, we should not give up. That's one of the most important messages.
And she adds that regardless of the current state of negotiations, it will be up to civil society to keep this issue of regulating autonomous weapons on the agenda.
I think that probably civil society, such as the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, they could really initiate a new process and it could kind of tell the international community, okay, we have to move forward, we have to move to another forum.
As for IPRA, after 5 years of work, this June 2022, it will be wrapping up its mandate. And I asked Anya, who helped start it all, what she was surprised by when she looks back all these years later to the start of IPRA.
So when we started this project in 2017, it was really set up for just 2 years because that was the initial mandate of the group of governmental experts as well. And I guess one surprise is how long we've been going now and how close we were able to get to the process. So we really discussed things, not just with states parties, but also with the chairs of the meetings. And I think could add value to the process. That was maybe not a surprise, but it was really nice to see.
And here's Elizabeth with what has stuck with her.
What was interesting for me was to see and realize that after 2 years solely dealing with autonomous weapon systems, you really need to listen to the other side. You know, you need to listen to those you think have an entirely different opinion because you can learn a lot from these people and vice versa. And I think in order to find a certain degree of consensus, it is always important to understand the other side. And I think that's what I've learned, not to have like an extreme opinion about lethal autonomous weapon systems.
As for IPRA's legacy, just because the official GGE process in Geneva is currently stuck, that doesn't mean that the work of IPRA was in vain. And it doesn't mean that our job in civil society is over. In fact, maybe it's just begun.
I think that it is now time to show the world that autonomous weapon systems will be on the agenda again. I know that right now, of course, the terrible war in Ukraine is in the focus of our minds, of our debates, of social media, but we will have to take autonomous weapon systems, artificial intelligence, machine learning into consideration. It will come up in the future. And this is why I think IPRA has undertaken a lot of substantial groundbreaking work and has provided the international community with a lot of scientific information, which can be used in future as well. All our reports, all our statements are available online. And I think if you are, for example, new to this topic, or you are a new student, researcher, or just any other civilian, it might be very important for you to have this kind of information. And the realities are as they are at the moment. But leaving the project with frustration would be an entirely wrong signal. On the contrary, I would say now it is more time than ever to show that we will find a solution, even though some states are obstructing this process.
So we'll have to wait and see what will happen next with efforts to regulate these weapon systems. Will the GGE continue to be stuck? Or will an independent group of countries take up the mantle? But I, for one, hope that we find a way to come together for some kind of agreement and stop autonomous weapons from ruling our skies or streets. Or at the very least, that there will be a reasonable human being on the other side of that button. For the SWP podcast, I'm Kevin Caners. And this was a special episode by our project, IPRA, the International Panel on the Regulation of Autonomous Weapons.
This was From Eye in the Sky to Killer Robots. For more information about IPRA and our reports, please visit us on Twitter and on our website, ipraw.org. That's IPRAW.org.